From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's start this hour with NPR's interview with President Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, who said he's made a counteroffer to special counsel Robert Mueller, which may be Mueller's last best chance, those are Giuliani's words, to secure testimony from President Trump for the Russia investigation. These negotiations have been dragging on for months. Let's bring in NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, who spoke with Giuliani yesterday. And Ryan, what do you think is going on here? Because Giuliani has probably already said this to Mueller, that this is his last best chance. Why is he saying it to you?
Well, I think that first of all, there's no reason for discussions about offers and counteroffers for these negotiations between the special counsel's office and the president's legal team to be discussed in public at all. The reason that they are being discussed is because it appears as though the president's legal team thinks that there's something to be gained from it. And it may be that it sets up an expectation in the public's mind that there is some sort of deadline for this to happen, a sense of good faith effort from the president, who has said that he would like to talk to Mueller. If it doesn't work out, if it comes to a head and it all kind of blows up, then it may give the president's team the opportunity to say, look, we were trying to get this done. The fault rests with the special counsel.
Yeah. Well, we also have President Trump tweeting out about an hour ago, this is an illegally brought, rigged witch hunt run by people who are totally corrupt and or conflicted. It was started and paid for by crooked Hillary and the Democrats. Phony dossier, FISA disgrace. Those are the warrants that's the warrant court. And so many lying and dishonest people already fired. 17 angry Dems. The president making a case again that this is a Democratic, as he said, witch hunt. But of course, Robert Mueller is a Republican. And then stay tuned. Boy, that doesn't feel like, you're happy with negotiations.
Well, the president has made his views of the special counsel's investigation clear for quite some time. We've heard a lot of what's in that tweet before, but the negotiations between the president's legal team and the special counsel's office, that's a serious business. This is not something that you can just simply say no to if special counsel Robert Mueller decides that he does indeed want to pursue this. He does have other options other than just coming to an agreement.
Yeah, well, and talk more about those options.
Well, there's always the possibility that the special counsel could decide to subpoena the president, to compel him to testify. When I asked Giuliani about that, he said he doesn't think that Mueller wants to take that route because in Giuliani's eyes, special counsel would not win that battle. Now, there are a lot of legal experts that I've spoken with who have said actually the law is largely on Mueller's side in this case, and that if it does go to the courts, that Mueller would likely prevail.
Yeah. And by the way, explain why the president's lawyers wouldn't want him to just go in and answer questions about something that he claims he had nothing to do with. Why not go in and just answer the questions and tell the truth?
Well, Giuliani says that they have a lot of concerns about questions. Well, first of all, he wouldn't get into the specifics of what the offer was, mm-hmm. but they do have concerns generally about questions related to potential obstruction of justice. And the way that Giuliani describes it is, you know, they have concerns that this could be a perjury trap, that the president would get a date wrong, would say something that's a little off from what's in a document or somewhere, and therefore be caught in some degree of perjury, and therefore he could be held accountable for that. So the easiest thing to do is to just not testify or to negotiate terms in which he would answer questions in written form, for example.
Well, and you have the president saying, stay tuned. Did you get a sense that we're going to get a sense soon of what's happening?
You know, Giuliani has tried to put a date on this. He says that he would like to see these negotiations wrapped up by September 1st, which is just around the corner. That's just a couple weeks away. You know, that's not a cut and dry date. That's a date that he's floating. He says that anything later than that would interfere possibly with midterm elections, which is something that the Justice Department doesn't like to do, is have an investigation that would potentially impact elections. But again, this is part of, I think, the president and his legal team's effort to kind of ramp up the pressure on the special counsel to get this investigation wrapped up as quickly as possible.
It's interesting. Giuliani said you don't want to do what you did in the last election, which is have, an interference in the election because of FBI investigations. Ryan, I just want to ask, in the few seconds we have, this is all happening as President Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, is on trial day 8. You've been following that. Might that end wrap up soon?
Well, the prosecutors said yesterday at the close of the day that they have around 8 witnesses to call. They expected to wrap up with all that by the end of the day Friday, which means they would conclude their portion of the case by the end of tomorrow. We don't know whether the defense will call any witnesses, but it seems like we're in the last couple days of that case there.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, there are new tensions this week in Venezuela after an apparent attack on President Nicolas Maduro. The assassination attempt happened over the weekend while he was giving a speech. The situation in Venezuela continues to deteriorate, causing thousands of people to flee to neighboring countries, including Brazil, which briefly shut down its border with Venezuela this week. Joining us on Skype from Caracas is the BBC's Guillermo Olmo. Guillermo, Maduro blames the U.S. as well as the extreme far-right groups in Venezuela for that apparent assassination attempt. What do we know about who was behind it?
Actually, it's really hard to say who is responsible for whatever happened. Both Santos and the U.S. government have denied taking part in the incident and suggested it might have been set up by the Venezuelan government itself to justify a crackdown on the opposition. However, Maduro appeared again in TV on Tuesday and showed video recordings of the alleged confessions of the 6 people already arrested by the security forces. And Maduro then named 2 prominent opposition figures, Julio Borges, now living in Colombia, and Juan Requesens, an outspoken young member of the opposition who was being arrested in Caracas while the president addressed the country.
There are many Venezuelans who are leaving the country, crossing the border into Brazil. There were some rulings on the border from Brazilian judges a couple days ago. The border was actually closed for a few hours between Venezuela and Brazil. What is the situation now?
Well, the situation now is business as usual because the border was reopened soon after that due to a rule from the Brazilian Supreme Court that allowed Venezuelans to get into Brazilian territory again. The thing is that local authorities from the Brazilian border state of Roraima had asked for a closure of the border, arguing that the Venezuelans getting into the country were collapsing the public services at this Brazilian Amazon state. But the federal government in Brasilia has so far turned them down, arguing that Venezuelans should have the right to flee the crisis in their country. So, as I said, now is business as usual at this border.
Meanwhile, Guillermo, you're in Caracas. What is it like there right now? We've heard about just unbelievable inflation, food shortages. What does it feel like in Caracas at the moment?
Well, I would say that there's a feeling of endurance. Venezuelans have to endure now the effects of a crippled economy. Not only Caracas, but many cities across the country suffer daily outages and even the lack of water. In addition, high crime and violence hit, especially the most vulnerable communities. This thing of violence and insecurity, it's been happening for years and is a problem shared by other Latin American countries. But what is now choking ordinary Venezuelans is the ongoing hyperinflation. Prices are a crazy thing here. The local currency, the Bolivar, is worth almost nothing. And things can get more expensive in less than 24 hours. So this is what is getting unbearable for people here right now.
Is there any sense that there is an end in sight to all of this?
No, sadly, I don't perceive this. When I talk to Venezuelans here, you know, many of them are trying to find their way out of the country. A lot of them just rely on the dollars they receive from someone. The political scene is so polarized. The government doesn't seem to be willing to really engage in a political dialogue with the opposition. And neither the opposition looks like in a position to become a real alternative. Well, the mismanagement has been in place for years, and I don't see anywhere in the horizon a solution in the short term.
Is the U.S. playing a constructive role?
That's a tough question. Among the government supporters, the U.S. Have a very bad image. there's a rooted assumption here, that is the Washington has played against Venezuelan in the past and has supported attempted against the legitimate governments of Hugo Chavez in the past, and this is something that the state media are continuously repeating, and it's I would say statute in mind of Venezuelans, especially of those supporting the government, and a few of them, to be honest. And actually, the perception of the Trump administration is that, well, apart from that thing of the sanctions, they are not actually in earnest interested in what could happen with this country in the future.
That is Guillermo Olmo, who is the BBC's correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. Guillermo, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was my pleasure.
California's largest wildfire is now more than 475 square miles in size. The state's fire agency, CAL FIRE, says the Mendocino Complex fire in Northern California is at 51% containment. Hundreds of homes and buildings have been destroyed. Meanwhile, further north, the Carr Fire is at 48% containment, and the Ferguson Fire near Yosemite National Park is nearly 80% contained. Yesterday, in an apparent bid to help, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross ordered the National Marine Fisheries Service to facilitate access to the water needed to fight the fires. That means officials can divert water from natural sources, overriding normal protections under the Endangered Species Act. This follows President Trump's tweets earlier this week, calling on California Governor Jerry Brown to allow the free flow of water instead of, quote, foolishly diverting it to the Pacific Ocean. Bill Stewart is a forestry specialist at the University of California, Berkeley. He joins us. Bill, when you hear that from the Commerce Secretary and the President, what do you think?
What I hear is conflating two different issues. One is an issue of how we deal with our rivers and our irrigation water is one issue, and the other is how we fight fires. And he's putting them both together. I think his major concern is fighting California's Endangered Species Act and our environmental regulations seems to be his major goal here.
And explain the connection there. The water in California is diverted already in part to help endangered species like the Chinook salmon, right?
Right. So they've been actually changing the amount of water they release from some of the big dams so that the rivers have water in them. But that means the reservoirs, instead of being 97% full, are 95% full. They still have by far enough water to put onto the wildfires.
So then why are the farmers in California so opposed to some of the water being used to preserve fish populations?
So as historically, all the rivers in California, all their water flowed out to the Pacific Ocean. And as we developed agriculture, we basically diverted more and more water out of those rivers onto irrigation. And so now there's been a shift back to reduce the amount of water that's being diverted from the rivers and used for irrigation. There's now requirements to have larger dams to pump out of groundwater or other sources that when you're using the water, it has a less of a negative impact on the salmon. So this has been a long-standing, fairly complicated discussion, dialogue we've been having in California for 30 years. But it really is a different, totally different issue than wildfire suppression up in the forested regions where we're having now.
Is there enough water right now to fight the fires in California?
Oh, yeah, there's enough water to fight the fires. And actually, most of the what really puts the fire out are basically people on the ground with they're actually cutting all the vegetation down to bare dirt, or the use of bulldozers to knock all the vegetation down. And what you see on television, the red retardant, which is actually a little bit more effective. It's more expensive, mm-hmm. but it's more effective than water. So water is kind of like in the toolbox, it's maybe 10% of the total issue.
In his tweet about the fires, President Trump also talked about removing trees to control fires, which is something that we've heard before. Is that a good part of the solution to stop these fires from getting as big as they are?
So removing some trees from the forest is a good way to basically reduce the amount of kindling in the forest. But it's always been part of forest management, not kind of something you only do during the fire.
What else can be done to prevent these massive fires from becoming the norm, or can anything? Is this just a changing climate? And, you know, unless there's a grand global solution, we can't stop it.
Well, I think the two things are, one is we are seeing the climate has having definitely driving up the amount of fires we're having in California every year. But the thing is, it is doing some level of removing shrubs and small trees from the forest to essentially reduce the amount of kindling that's out there. Harvesting the big trees isn't the solution. It's harvesting the smaller stuff that catches on fire first is what we call vegetation management, which has always been part of the solution we've been doing here in California.
Now, Bill, you are joining us from the Sierra Nevada in California from a forestry camp that you're putting on right now in Quincy, California. Does it look dry to you? What does the forest look like there?
Well, we're about 100 miles from the big fires. The sunrise was very red because of the smoke in the air. But this year, we don't have a fire in this area. But about once every 5 years, there's often a fire filling up this valley with smoke. So it's a common occurrence to have fires in California pretty much every other year, if wherever you are.
That's Bill Stewart, who is a forestry specialist at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Well, now to a startling admission this morning from the government of Puerto Rico. In a draft report to Congress requesting $139 billion in recovery funds, the Puerto Rican government has admitted that more than 1,400 people died as a result of Hurricane Maria last September. This isn't an official number. The government is waiting on the results of a more careful study, but the initial toll was put at 64. After charges of undercounting, the government retracted that number. Well, in addition to the catastrophic loss of lives and property, Maria blew away any remaining cover for the island's dire fiscal crisis. Connecticut Public Radio's Diane Orson visited the island and spoke with artists about how shifting financial priorities could affect them.
Tomas Gonzalez Hernandez is crouched on the floor of his downtown San Juan studio. He's cutting, gluing, and reshaping old street posters into new works of art.
I'm interested in that kind of objects because that kind of objects got a history in their environment.
Gonzalez says the aftermath of Hurricane Maria has pushed him in new artistic directions.
Maria was a really, really tough experience to the island, to the people, to the government. And yes, right now, my work is going to start to get a little more patriotic, is the word.
He says his next project will be based on how well he can support himself. To earn rent money, Gonzalez performs on the streets as a juggler.
And I'm going to do an installation because everyone is juggling right now.
Juggling and struggling, like other artists, to reimagine what arts and culture will look like on the island in the coming years. Maximiano Valdez is music director of the Puerto Rico Symphony Orchestra. He says classical music funding in Puerto Rico historically was modeled on a European vision, which sees the arts as a responsibility of government.
So we have many things covered by the state: museums, orchestras, festivals, schools. This was organized according to the Spanish tradition of Puerto Rico.
And that's changing now, says Valdez. He's concerned the shift could threaten long-established arts institutions and is advocating for more private sector support for classical music. Eduardo Arosemena is chairman of the board for the Puerto Rico Culture Institute. He and other government officials are working with the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board created by Congress to restructure Puerto Rico's debt.
They have been making some tough decisions, and they reduce the institute's operational budget by 89%.
The institute's mission is to promote arts and culture on the island.
It has been mostly government-sponsored, and we want to pivot to seeking private support, private philanthropy. We're going to create our first endowment fund. This is not help for the government. This is help for young, talented, aspiring painters and aspiring musicians and artists.
But Rosario Romero, a professor of art history at the University of Puerto Rico, is critical of the shift toward privatization. She's originally from Spain and sees the move as part of a larger abdication by the island government of its responsibility to its citizens. She argues this strategy began before the storm, starting with cuts to public arts education.
Yo no creo que hay un antes y un después de María. En cuanto a las instituciones,
I do not believe there is a before and after Maria in terms of educational institutions in Puerto Rico. Rather, I think Maria has accelerated the destruction of that which is public, because I believe the government of Puerto Rico has used it as a way to cancel on its responsibility.
Romero credits local nonprofits with stepping in just after the storm to offer critically needed help to Puerto Rico's arts community. One group, Beta Local, created an emergency fund. Money went to artists for basic necessities and to help those who'd lost workshops and collections. Co-director Michael Linares says Beta also began a mapping project, identifying where cultural workers live and work throughout Puerto Rico. He describes support of the arts as critical to nation building.
We make culture, you know, that's our product, which is an important thing for us to protect. Because when things like this happen, we understand that one of the first areas in society to be dismantled is culture, you know. And, you know, our nation gets weak if that happens.
Eduardo Arosemena of the Puerto Rico Culture Institute stresses that not all fiscal cuts have been made by the island government, but have been required by the U.S. government's oversight board.
We are in a process where we have to reach agreements with the oversight board. And, for example, you have certain areas where you cannot cut health, education, security, law enforcement. You have to have doctors and teachers and cops.
And he hopes eventually the government's new endowment fund will offer opportunities to young artists to further their careers. For Here and Now, I'm Diane Orson.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
New York City has become the first major U.S. city to halt new licenses for Uber and Lyft. The city also capped the number of ride-hailing cars on the streets for a year to study things like traffic congestion. Charisse Jones is a reporter at USA Today and joins me in the studio here in New York. Hi, Charisse.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is behind this city council passing this set of regulations?
Well, city council members feel that in a city where the traffic has always been horrific, that it's gotten significantly worse now that you've got tens of thousands of other cars and drivers kind of clogging the streets. Mm-hmm. And they're also worried that a lot of these drivers are working around the clock and not making enough money to live on. So these rules are designed to address that and might be a model for other cities around the country that are dealing with an industry that's really disrupting how we get around.
That the Uber and Lyft drivers are not making enough money to
exactly,
live on.
Exactly, yes. And the drivers for Via and some of the other services that we have.
And they feel that if you sort of cap the supply of these cars, that maybe the prices will go up. Consumers might have to pay more, but the drivers may also get paid more. They'll get more rides.
Exactly. If you've got all of this demand and not enough drivers to fulfill it, people are going to make a lot more fares, and that's going to be better for them, even though the prices might go up for some of the commuters because they're waiting longer and there's more competition to get a car.
I imagine those yellow taxi drivers are pretty happy about this.
I think they're ecstatic. I mean, it's been a real thorn in their side. I mean, they were the only game in town for decades, mm-hmm. right? And now they've got all of this competition. In New York City, to drive a yellow cab, you need a medallion. That
costs a lot of money.
Used to cost more than $1 million, and now it's valued at about $200,000. So you've got people that have put all their money into these things, and now they're not worth as much. And you've actually even had drivers who've committed suicide.
Right, a number of them.
Yeah, they're been about 6. And so it's really causing a lot of financial strain. So they're happy to see these new rules.
And what about traffic? What might the effect be on traffic of capping this? Are you really going to be able to get people to go back to the subway if they've gotten used, in some cases,
right,
to switching to a ride-hailing, maybe even a pool car with a number of people in it that might be a comparable price to what they would pay to get on the subway?
You know, folks have really gotten dependent on these services. I mean, I was taking the subway in this morning to work, and I was late because there's always a stall or a delay. The platforms are packed. And so it's become a real crucial option for commuting in this city. And so they're going to probably have to do more than capping an Uber driver to address the traffic problem. You know, congestion pricing is being considered to make you pay more if you drive into the city. So it's going to take more than this, but it might be a bit of a help.
How do New Yorkers feel about this?
I think New Yorkers are worried. I mean, so many folks hop into a VIA on a rainy day. If you've tried to get a cab, you know how awful that can be. Again, the subway has been really troubled, really plagued. And so I think if we do see longer wait times or higher prices, that a lot of New Yorkers are going to be very upset.
One of the things that people may not realize is that in a lot of cities in this country, if you get into an Uber or a Lyft, it could be anybody's car. It's
right.
Not a special license plate. But here in New York City already,
yes,
even before these regulations, all of the Uber and Lyft drivers have a special license plate.
Exactly. It's more regulated in New York than in other cities because it's a city that depends on public transportation and ride-hailing services and cabs for folks to get to where they've got to go. A lot of folks don't have a private car.
And I imagine that a lot of other cities are going to be watching what New York City does and how this works out to cap the number, because all kinds of cities are having their own issues with taxis, with Ubers, with Lyfts, and with public transit. Charisse Jones, a reporter at USA Today, great to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Lyme disease is now in all 50 states. That's according to Quest Diagnostics, which analyzed 6 million blood samples. Pennsylvania had the most cases of the tick-borne disease, but it's also becoming more common in places like Florida and California. The bacteria that causes Lyme can lead to long-term problems in the brain, heart, and joints if it goes untreated. Joining us now is Wendy Adams, Research Grant Director for the Bay Area Lyme Foundation. Her group released its own research last month that shows ticks capable of carrying Lyme have been found in 83 new counties across the country. Wendy, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we have talked about Lyme disease for a long time, but when you look at the map of where Lyme disease is most concentrated in this country, it tends to be in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest. Now we're hearing about it being in all 50 states. What is your takeaway from that?
Well, so I think it's important to talk about the testing and the reporting here, because while it's been reported in 50 states, it doesn't mean that the bacteria is actually living in the ticks of all those 50 states. Lyme disease is reported where it's diagnosed, but not necessarily where it's contracted. So while we say that it's been diagnosed in 50 states, it's not necessarily in the ticks in all 50 states.
Meaning that the ticks are being brought there from other states, or that somebody's getting infected somewhere else and then they live in those states and then that state gets reported as a state with Lyme disease.
Precisely. So somebody from a state that doesn't have Lyme might go on vacation to California or New York, get infected there, but not be diagnosed until they're back in their home state. That gets reported then as an infection from a state which may not have Lyme disease actually in the ticks in that particular state. So it's an important distinction. But nonetheless, the ticks really are moving. There are ticks in more counties than we thought there were. And there are different pathogens in the ticks than we had expected when we started the study.
California, where you are, and Florida each had about 500 cases of Lyme disease. What do you think's going on there? Are those all people that got a bite somewhere else?
No, and I'll speak about California. California's had Lyme disease living in the ticks for you know, ever since the late 70s. So we have the first documented cases seen in California in the late 70s. So this isn't something new. What we are seeing is a real increase in diagnosis, or at least an increase in the positive tests. And that's really interesting because, for example, in 2017, about 500 were reported through Quest, but only about 160 were reported to the county health departments that record the infections. So the question really is, are more people getting infected or are more people just getting diagnosed? And if more people are getting diagnosed, then how is the rate of diagnosis increasing so rapidly from the early 2010s when it was only about 100 cases being reported through Quest? I think also important is that Quest is, isn't 100% market share in California. So we know that there are probably other people testing positive through tests that are not given by Quest. Mm.
Now, you, as part of your research, asked people to send tick samples to you from all over the country. How did you do that?
We did. We did that by basically putting the word out through our website and through other groups that we know. And what we found is that people were really eager to participate. They had heard so much about ticks. They saw them on themselves and their pets, and they really wanted to help us do the research to find out what's in these ticks.
And you found that 24 states have counties where ticks that carry Lyme were discovered for the first time. What else surprised you about what you found?
So I think what surprised us is that we really saw ticks in places we didn't expect, specifically the ticks that have Lyme disease, but also other ticks. And we found pathogens in the ticks that we didn't expect to see and that hadn't been seen in those numbers before. For example, we saw Lone Star ticks, which are the ticks with the characteristic dot on the back. That's thought really to be, an East Coast, Southern tick. However, we've had two submissions from Northern California. In addition, we saw Ixodes ticks, which are the ticks that carry Lyme disease. We saw the Lyme pathogen in the smallest ticks, in the larvae ticks, which are just from eggs that hatch. Those ticks had the Lyme pathogen in them, and that really wasn't expected.
Whenever I am in any possible danger of a tick getting on my body, I obviously check myself, but I have heard that the ticks that carry Lyme are so small that you might not even be able to see them.
Well, and that's why this larvae finding is so important. Those ticks are really about the size of a poppy seed or the period at the end of a sentence on a typewritten page. They're really hard to see. And so, typically people get a tick bite. If they see it, they go into their doctor and tell them they've been bitten by a tick. That helps the doctor, determine if tick-borne disease could be one of the reasons they're feeling sick. When somebody doesn't see a tick, that's a critical piece of information that the doctor is missing, which might lead them more quickly to diagnosing a tick-borne disease.
We're also seeing reports this week that a new species of tick from Asia called the longhorn tick has appeared on the East Coast. How significant is that?
Well, it's very significant because if that carries probably different pathogens, right? We know it carries viruses, and those have shown to be, they cause a lot of human disease in the places where that tick is established. We don't know, we haven't linked them to human disease in the United States yet, but it does cause disease in cattle and livestock. So that's something we need to really be careful and look for in humans, and also let the doctors know that there's this new tick circulating that might have different pathogens that we haven't recognized in humans yet.
So when we hear a story like this, that there are ticks showing up or that there's Lyme disease showing up in places that it hasn't before, many people look at that and say, this must be a result of climate change. It is not getting cold enough anymore in some of these areas to kill off the ticks. Is that part of what's going on?
Well, I think it certainly could be, and we'll have to watch this over several years. Ticks are very hardy creatures. They will use any environmental advantage that they can, but they will be around no matter what the climate is. So I think it's important to really study the ticks, study the level of pathogens in the ticks, and then realize that, a cold year, a hot year, they're going to be there no matter what.
Is there anything that can be done about this growing tick population?
So there are studies about novel genetic methods to control ticks in certain populations. It's hard to do. I'll speak from the perspective of California. California is a very ecologically diverse state. And so what might work in a tick in Sonoma County might not work in a tick in Monterey County because the environments are different and the animals that the ticks feed on are different. Mm. So I'm not sure that unless you're on a contained environment like Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket or an island that we have a clear way to control tick populations by controlling the mouse population, for example. But people do need to look at their environment, look at the plants and things they have in their backyard, how close they are to their house. They need to think about controlling ticks in their pets because pets can bring ticks indoors. And those are the ways that we can kind of in the near term worry about controlling the ticks. But using that as our only way of reducing the Lyme disease or the tick-borne disease burden is probably not going to happen in the near future.
And just because you've probably freaked out a lot of our listeners, give them one piece of advice. What should people do to try and stop themselves from getting Lyme disease from a tick?
Yes. So to reduce tick-borne infection, what you really want to do is when you're outside, try and stay away from long grasses, leaf litter, and fallen trees. You want to stay in the middle of pathways when you're out hiking or walking. And when you come in, you really want to throw your clothes in the dryer for 10 minutes, take a shower, and then do a tick check. And that will reduce a good part of the risk of contracting tick-borne disease.
That's Wendy Adams, who is the Research Grant Director for the Bay Area Lyme Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And as Lyme disease gets more common, many of you may have had experiences with it. We'd love to hear about those at hereandnow.org.
Today at the Pentagon, Vice President Mike Pence laid out the Trump administration's plan to create the first new branch of the military in more than 70 years.
Now the time has come to write the next great chapter in the history of our armed forces, to prepare for the next battlefield, where America's best and bravest will be called to deter and defeat a new generation of threats to our people, to our nation. The time has come to establish the United States Space Force.
President Trump tweeted out, "Space Force all the way." But a new Space Force would require approval from Congress, and some military leaders have complained that adding a sixth branch to the armed forces would just add red tape at the Pentagon. Let's bring in Pat Duggins, a news director at Alabama Public Radio, longtime space journalist. Pat, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And past administrations have floated this idea of a Space Force. First of all, what's the picture of it? Is it to launch attacks from space to Earth? Is it to protect things we have in space, like satellites? How would it work?
Well, Robin, when President Trump first started talking about this, the first flashback that I had was to that James Bond movie, Moonraker, where you had space soldiers out there with their little jetpacks and their zappy lasers and things. What Vice President Pence was talking about today was simply like rearranging deck chairs on a cruise ship. You're just taking some capabilities away from the Air Force, and maybe some R&D would be thrown in, but Mr. Trump can't even get full funding for his wall, so it's really hard to see where it's going to go.
Well, when you say some things from the Air Force, again, are they to be up there in space? What's the sense of it?
Well, they're talking mostly about like being able to do spy satellite capabilities and anti-satellite capabilities. It's very little, stuff like, you know, like having manned armed platforms or anything like that. Nothing like that was suggested. Having astronauts in space that would simply, you know, wear, you know, like sergeant's, you know, stripes or whatever. Nothing like that was mentioned. It's just the same kind of surveillance and anti-missile capabilities that the U.S. Space Command under the Air Force is doing right now.
Well, and that's why some have said, why not just make it a space force or enlarge the command that's already there in the Air Force, much like the Marines, completely independent, but are a part of the Department of the Navy. But Pence made the argument today that a space force is even more relevant now because American adversaries are already threatening dominance in space. Let's listen.
Both China and Russia have been conducting highly sophisticated on-orbit activities that could enable them to maneuver their satellites into close proximity of ours, posing unprecedented new dangers to our space systems.
You know, others are saying we have set up a scenario where we are dependent on these things floating up in space to kind of run our lives, you know, the satellites with everything they do. Doesn't he make the point that we're vulnerable?
Well, the one point that they brought up, and let's face facts, really the only person who really seems to like this idea is President Trump. But one thing that has been brought up is the creation of hypersonic missiles by Russia and by China. Now, if you're going to have like a hypersonic weapon which flies way above the speed of sound, you have to have some kind of an interceptor missile to be able to catch it. If you go to the Udvar-Hazy Center at the Smithsonian, you've got the SR-71 Blackbird, which was a CIA spy plane, flew so fast it didn't need any defensive weapons because no missile could catch it. Now, if you arm an object moving that fast, it would seem that the United States would want to have, you know, some kind of capability to knock it down, which we don't currently have.
Yeah. Well, President Trump does speak a lot about space. He signed an order late last year promising to send Americans back to the moon. And here he is earlier this year at a rally in Michigan.
We have reinvigorated our space program to a level that nobody thought possible in this short period of time. NASA is back. NASA is back.
Wait a minute. Isn't the space shuttle still shut down? So how do people who follow NASA feel about this?
Well, we're already dependent on the Russians to send human beings to the International Space Station. And right now, and this is one big problem, the Air Force controls a rocket called the Atlas V, which is like the big heavy lift booster that carries things up into space. That rocket uses Russian engines. And as soon as President Trump imposed these sanctions against Russia because of the poisoning of Sergei Skripal, the spy in the UK, one of the first things that Mr. Putin says is, I'm going to cut off your rocket engines. And if he does that, that means no more Atlas V.
Well, last week we learned more about astronauts who will fly to the International Space Station on private spacecraft as soon as next year with Boeing and with SpaceX. There would be the same vulnerability there if Russia stops selling rockets to a U.S. company like Boeing.
Well, Elon Musk is probably happy because his SpaceX rockets actually have their own U.S.-built engines on it. Mm-hmm. The Boeing capsule that you alluded to would be launched on an Atlas V, which, by the way, is built here in Alabama, and that's the one that uses the RD-180 engines that we import from Moscow. So one of those two rockets would be, you know, offline, assuming that Mr. Putin follows through on his threat.
Well, we've heard the criticism. We have just a few seconds here. People say a space force would add another layer of bureaucracy, cost more money, could be a step toward militarizing space, but you only got like 15 seconds. Does something have to happen to organize more thought about security in space?
Well, let's put it this way. There's an unofficial communique out of Moscow that apparently Mr. Putin said during the Helsinki meeting with Mr. Trump that nobody attended, apparently, that one thing he didn't want to have was weapon systems in space, which could be very destabilizing.
Yeah. Pat Duggins, news director at Alabama Public Radio, longtime space journalist. His book, Trailblazing Mars, out in paperback. Take a look at that. Pat, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'll follow this idea of a space force. Your thoughts, hearnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young, along with Jeremy Hobson. It's Here Now.